Bauman?
Present.
Shute? McNaughton? Mogul?
Present.
Needhammer?
Present.
Place?
Present.
Jeff Ross?
Here.
Monica Ross?
Here.
Larry did contact us, said he's going to be on the stage tonight and requested to be excused.
Okay.
I'll make a motion to excuse Larry.
Got a motion to excuse Larry?
I'll second.
Motion second. We have to do a roll call now that we're all together?
No.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, move on to consent agenda. Approval of minutes from March 15th, 2021.
I just have a question on that. Again, it's nothing is wrong with minutes. But when we gave the developer the okay to do 314 North Park, that six-unit building,
yes.
And he was using the alley as his access.
Correct.
I know we discussed, and he agreed to have it paved. Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
You are remembering that correctly, and he was going to have, and his whole approval was contingent on him having that, having some sort of management over, but
that's not part of these minutes.
No, it was a question that, no, well, it is part of these minutes.
It was part of it because we had public comment.
Part of the minutes prior, not these minutes, that 100%.
March 15th.
We had some.
Public comment.
Community asking questions about it.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Some of the community asking questions about it, and something we had already resolved.
Okay.
We had a maintenance agreement. Their approval was hinged upon a maintenance agreement for being able to use that alleyway.
Yeah.
One of the persons that uses that alley had contacted me and asked me about it. And just said that the guy is saying, I got my approval, I don't have to pave it. It's the city's property.
Monica, we can talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
But if there's a question about the minutes, for some reason I thought it was a question about the minutes.
Yeah, oh, no, the minutes are fine.
Okay.
I move that we approve the consent calendar.
I've got a motion to approve the minutes.
A second.
A motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Vote. All right. Move on to hearing citizens present on non-agenda items. Anyone here for that? All right. Let's go right on to reports of officers, boards, and standing committees.
Just the marijuana task force meeting was scheduled for tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a totally coincident date.
Yeah.
420 stands or something.
I understand.
They'll be meeting tomorrow and hopefully developing the public engagement process.
Okay. All right. Move on to unfinished business, which there is none. Let's go right on to new business, alley vacation request for 1415 Pleasant Avenue.
Okay, this is a request from the Elms to vacate a portion of the alley that is behind their house at 1415 Pleasant. The alley is approximately 132 feet in length, and it's a typical 16.5-foot wide alley. And this is their home, and then they own this property behind, and it's bisected by this alley. Their home and garage, you can't really tell from this picture, but the garage sits right in the middle of the alley, and it's obviously undeveloped, full of trees and all that. So they're requesting to vacate that portion of the alley.
Okay.
The city staff has reviewed this. DPW, water and sewer, we saw no need for this alley or future extension of any utility or access. I had no issues with the proposal. And it was also reviewed by the Parks and Recs Committee as its proximity to Avalanche Park and whether there's any benefit for the park to have this property. And they saw no issue with the vacating. It now comes to you for your review and recommendation to the city commission. And then they'll go to the city commission and they'll determine whether to move forward or they can rest. And if so, they'll set up a public hearing to formally vacate the alley. So I believe the Elms are here to support the request.
Okay.
If you have any questions, we have an answer.
All right. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Not really.
Wood Ranch has been there since 1950. There's a tree that's been there longer than that. And it's about 10 feet from the house. The garage.
The alley.
But the tree, yeah, the tree's in pretty rough shape too, so.
It's a big tree.
It's a old locust tree.
Okay.
And the picture that we got, is the shaded area in blue, is that the preserve stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So the only question I have is just this one lot that's kind of not in the preserve, but still hanging out that alley?
Yeah.
What do we know about that one lot?
That's owned by Mr. Smith, that owns the property in front of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, which is, that's the old radiator shop, I don't know if you're...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But we're just looking at just a portion of it.
Right, just...
Yes, good.
Is there any point to having Timber Lane still on the map?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a private street and it's used for a water line right now. That blue line that runs through it.
Yeah.
There's a water line that runs up through Avalanche.
Okay. But we don't see the street being developed ever?
Probably never developed for access, but it is being used for utilities.
I kind of live up the hill from there, I'm just curious.
Sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions about it?
So I guess my other question would be, in the same motion or the same procedure, would it make sense to close the whole alley? Or don't you do that because it's not being requested?
Well, this is the request that's in front of you. The city can initiate that on their own bracket if they wanted to.
I got it.
But it couldn't be part of this request.
And this is just a recommendation to the city.
Yeah, I'm just trying to say, let's clean it all up, but two separate issues, I get it.
Mm-hmm. So you get past this property owner here, and then you start getting into where that alley abuts the preserve.
Right.
So you may not want to vacate that portion. You want to maintain that as part of the preserve.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, based on that, Chair, I'll make a motion that we recommend to the commission to go ahead with the vacation of this section of the alley.
Okay. Is there any other?
I'll second it.
We have a motion second. Is there any other discussion on this?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. No, this was something that was recommended to me after there's a motion and a second to see if there's anything else that needs to be discussed. All right. A motion and second. Roll call, Pat.
Jeff Ross.
Aye.
Monica Ross?
Aye.
Bowman?
Aye.
Moblo?
Aye.
Needhammer?
Aye.
Place?
Aye.
All right, so this will be placed on the city commission agenda perhaps as soon as next week. I'll let you know if it's on there. But that's the next part of the process where they review the request and whether it's determined whether to move it forward.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to new business B, Planning Commission appointment recommendations.
I don't see either one here, and I did get a response from Rachel saying that she was working and didn't know if she would be able to make this meeting. And I did get a response from Tim Nemechek. I would propose a push us off for the last item and do our other business, and maybe they'll throw up and then...
We'll see. Yeah, I think that's a great idea, Scott. Let's move on to new business C, plan, unit, development, ordinance, discussion. Yeah.
You may recall that as the planning commission was discussing housing barrier amendments and maybe possible future amendments, the one article in the ordinance that I was kind of looking at was the residential cluster housing development option ordinance. That ordinance has been used twice, I know, since I've been here, or once before I was here, and once since I've been here. And it produced the Canyon Lane development approach heights. And I wouldn't call either one of them wildly successful. And I don't think it's really a good model to more efficiently develop housing. Steve was kind enough to kind of review it and come up with some ideas and some concepts that we wanted to discuss and maybe get some ideas to start the development of an ordinance to replace that existing.
Yeah, thank you for your time today. Thanks for allowing me to give some input. You know, a lot of the stuff that we look at when we're trying to lower barriers to housing, and a lot of what we look at, I have to say, your city staff and all of you have done a really great job already putting together a lot of ordinance amendments that you've already adopted that has really lowered a lot of barriers. I think a lot of people are finding more housing opportunities to build in Boyne City. You know, we can always do just a little bit more, just do it incrementally and then figure out, you know, just do it in a way that is compatible with your surrounding land uses. And I think one of the things that you could look at, and this comes from, this idea generally comes from an Emmett County ordinance that they've had in their books for a while and they're finding it more and more useful as we go on. And that's to allow for what's called a residential overlay planned unit development district, where you could have somebody who has a larger piece of property, maybe something just a little bit larger than your minimum lot size lot, but not necessarily like 2 to 5 acres, which I think right now the cluster housing has 5 acre minimum, right? So something just a little bit larger than the current minimum, and anybody who wanted to do anything more than 2 homes on the property, which you already allow in your zoning districts, which is terrific. And just looking incrementally larger if you wanted to put another third unit or fourth or more to give somebody a little bit of a bonus to allow for that to happen, where if they were, especially if they were doing it in a way that's compatible with surrounding land uses, keep the buildings together, maybe do a duplex or closer together in the middle and create a little larger setback around the outside, or maybe some green space, some evergreen hedges or something like that to separate themselves. Allow for them to create an additional housing unit, because every time you're able to allow somebody to put another housing unit on that property, you're reducing the overall cost per housing unit. So you may not necessarily be requiring that it be sold at a certain amount, but you're at least allowing for the opportunity for somebody to build something that's just a little bit less expensive. And the demand is out there. Demand for housing is out there at just about every price level, but the demand is really big in the lowest market. So what this does is it proposes, if you have a lot size of about, like, let's say the rural estate district, your R&D district, if you have a minimum lot size of about 15,000 square feet or more, if you allow it, then somebody may be able to build 3 or 4 homes on it, to a density that's a little bit greater than what you allow right now, which is, I think, 10,000 square feet, I believe, per dwelling unit. And then allowing for a lot size of about 7,000 square feet. That would create quite a bonus if you were allowed to build an extra couple dwelling units on that property. And the TRD district, traditional residential, very similar percentage. Right now you require 5,445 square feet, which is really good to begin with. But this will also allow for a lot size of 3,000 square feet. Now that's not necessarily the minimum lot size. You could still have the 5,445, but if you were to start adding more dwelling units, you could calculate that out at 3,000 square feet per dwelling unit. So if you had 3 dwelling units on there, you'd only have to have a 9,000 square foot property instead of a 10,000. I'm sorry, more than that. I'm not doing the calculation because you've got duplexes and other residential that's allowed on there. But either way, it's a little bit more of a bonus. I think right now the open space option allows for a 20% reduction in density, and this calculates out a little bit more than that. I was trying to run some numbers just down the back of my napkin here, and it looks like it's a little bit more like 70% reduction, or I'm sorry, greater reduction than that. It's greater than 80%. So, like I said, every little bit helps with this. I think, one of the other items on here, and this is maybe a little bit bigger change than a lot of people have considered, but Traverse City and some other places are doing this. In fact, quite more and more all the time are considering removing the minimum dwelling unit size. And what that does, it seems kind of radical, but when you think about it, right now, the way that people, when you're building, there's already $20,000 $40,000 in site prep and utilities and just getting a house ready for development. So when you're spending that kind of money already, you're not going to build a 500 or 600 square foot home, which is what's the current minimum right now?
572.
Yeah, 4 5 7 2?
672.
672, okay. So this would, so that's a very small house, and the average house size is going up. I think it's maybe 1600 or 1800 square feet now on average, and it used to be about 1200 square feet. So people are building bigger all the time. What this typically has the effect of doing when you remove the minimum dwelling unit size is it makes it more possible for somebody to build a reasonably sized duplex, where you can have two smaller units in the same building without necessarily having, you know, a 12 or 1400 square foot building. It's a limited market for that, but it is a market. You know, there are people who want to move to the area and they need a place for a little while, or they're investing in a rental. It might be more a long-term rental that somebody has for the workforce that might want to rent there. So you're able to build a smaller dwelling unit. Usually with it, that minimum dwelling size being below 672 is usually only going to be experienced in a multifamily project. So I think that's something definitely to consider. And then whether or not short-term rentals would be permitted in this, obviously it sounds like you're having that, some of the conversation at the city level to some extent as to what you're going to allow, if you're going to have an ordinance or not. But I think all you have to do is just, again, this is what I'm proposing to you here for your consideration, is just something to think about to remove the barriers to housing. And with short-term rentals, a short-term rental isn't a house. It doesn't serve as a house in your community. It doesn't serve as a place for people to live. They're going to go to school or be employed in the area. They're important for economic development, but really what we're trying to do is remove the barriers to housing. So I encourage you to consider some of these being not for short-term rentals, but again, that would be probably more for you to consider in a bigger picture policy conversation, but I think it's something the city's talking about. That's a quick highlight. If anybody has any specific questions about these ideas, I'm happy to talk a little more about them. How do they sound to you, Phil? I guess, too, I'm curious.
Well, I mean, a lot of them didn't sound too radical. I mean, honestly. The other part is that reducing the minimum dwelling size, there's already standards in place at the county level that people are going to have to follow anyways.
Right.
And are those the 673 square feet?
No, that's a city standard. The other standard in that equation is the minimum width. And that sometimes is more prohibitive than the actual square footage. Mm-hmm. So it gives people the flexibility to perhaps, you know, have a narrower dwelling unit that's, you know, easier to construct. That does allow modulars, manufacturers, easier. And that's a reason why there's a lot of minimum widths in ordinances to prevent those.
Sure.
So if that's still, you know, policy, you know, that's something you want to consider.
Yeah, and that's, in fact, I experienced that too. Scott has been helpful with me. My wife and I have a piece of property in town that we're still thinking of putting a new home on. And when we look at some of these smaller manufactured houses, they're really nice looking, and yet there is a dimension that's narrower than 24 feet. So because we're trying to, as we designed our last house, it blossomed into a 3,600 square foot home before we pulled the plug and said, we gotta do this, let's start again. So we pulled back and we started looking at a smaller home that was about 1,100 square feet. But most of the ones that we could get at a reasonable rate that were prefab up in, it's called Dickinson Homes up in UP, really nice houses, but there was always a dimension that was shorter, that was narrower than 24. So that's definitely something to consider too, if you don't know. And about the building codes too, I think that's a great point. I used to oversee the building code department at Sheboygan County, and when I sat down with my building official just to see how small can we go and meet code, it was he could play around with a bunch of numbers, and it was like just over 200 square feet, 240 square feet, I think, if I remember right, was the general area that he could look at, where the bathroom met all the requirements for spacing between toilet and sink and that, and then minimum size for a bedroom. And you really didn't, you had to have some cooking facilities, but the spacing there, you really didn't have to have that much space.
In that square footage, you're talking an apartment in a multi-unit building.
In some,
an individual house.
Correct, typically. Now, but if you remove the minimum dwelling unit size, you would be offering the opportunity for somebody to build something like that. But you'd also have to remove that 24-foot minimum width. Mm-hmm. But typically, it's going to be in a multi-unit. Yeah. Because like the tiny homes that you talk, that you probably see around, are usually on trailers.
Right.
And that wouldn't be permitted.
No.
They wouldn't be construction code. They're titled as RVs.
Right.
And they wouldn't be permitted. I'm sorry.
So with the 24-foot restriction, is that to prohibit the modulars from being a manufactured home in the same place?
Well, it's not stated directly.
But that was the underlying
discriminatory process. But it's more of an architectural desire.
Yeah.
Is there another way of wording it that could maybe open up the possibility to some of those tiny homes that are, you know, permanently fixed to the property?
That's a great question. I think
it's not like my generation. That's a huge push. You know, the younger generations, they're not necessarily having kids right away. They're looking for smaller options and, you know, so.
You know, it's been the kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge part of zoning for 40 years, probably 50 years, where you put it at 24 feet, you're not going to get a mobile home in your neighborhood.
Right.
But the reality is, and as we saw in the examples that were given for the Fox Run, you know, the new ones are a lot better. And you can't move a one older than 1978, I think, right now, according to Michigan code. So if you remove that 24 minimum width, you know, yeah, you're going to have somebody, you open it up to allow somebody to build something ugly. They can build something ugly more than 24 feet. So it's meant to be an aesthetic control, but I think in the end, that right now, especially when you need more housing, I think it's maybe an unnecessary control.
Now, by allowing this kind of thing through a special use permit process, there would be this kind of review and architectural design, and so there would be some, you know, ability to review exactly what's going to be constructed. It's just going to be allowing whatever units to come on once the decision's made.
Right, so that would be, if we remove that barrier, we can still put in place to have a review of the project.
But that's only if it's a PUD.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're
talking about. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Great point. And it is part of this discussion here that you could, maybe you, as part of the PUD overlay, you would remove that.
Right, you'd have to have the PUD overlay before those can be initiated.
Yep. But one of the other things was not just the gift that we were talking about at one point, the pitch of the roof was also another barrier to restrict self-manufactured homes, but that seems to be going by the wayside because they've changed that up as well.
There were two designs we looked at that did that was prohibitive in that situation. Because of the narrow width of the building, too, really keep it one square. But yeah, it's bit by bit. I think I look at each thing you can and make those changes.
So, but the width, 24, didn't we have some language that says the house has to, they can't sit endo on a lot?
Right, there is replacement requirements, but again, this would be a PUD overlay, so you're kind of overriding all those regulations and developing them specifically for these applications.
So, for example, the lot that was for sale last year, I looked at it, my company looked at it, it's right by your house, the corner of and
West.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful lot. It was too small by a few feet to build two homes.
Right, it's a double lot.
But it's a double lot, but I couldn't get two homes in. But if I did a PUD overlay, I could get four homes, maybe. Or eight tiny homes, maybe.
Yeah.
Is that what, is that kind of, this an interpretation?
Yeah, this is the kind of application that this is looking for. In all of those. I think the best opportunities are small ones. And that kind of lot right there where, you know, it's a big lot, but it's not big enough.
Not big enough for two.
That would be a great lot for...
And it's got water and sewer, so it's a definite, you know, it's on a paved street. So it's a great development opportunity. And this would allow more density.
That would be a great lot for like a fourplex. Two facing one way, two facing the other.
But you couldn't do it unless...
Only with the PUD.
Only with the PUD, yep.
Right, but a two-story, I mean, that would be, and it's a nice neighborhood for a family.
Well, it's a great neighborhood, don't you?
Right.
Until you got that beautiful walnut tree you don't want to cut down.
That's what housed all the squirrels that used to be in the house that was there.
Yeah, but that's an interesting concept. So you're taking a lot that can allow one house. It's nothing more than a lot. It's a corner lot. And now it's potentially four.
Yeah, that would be a great spot.
Which points out you're taking away a barrier.
Right.
And you're making it more cost effective for any developer.
Right.
So would these lots be automatically granted that overlay, or would it be something you would have to apply for through the city?
It'd be a special use permit if you're planning, the way it's being formatted right now, it'd be a review by the planning commission, so basically a special use permit kind of process. And then once that's granted, that they go with the land, so they would have that to do whatever is approved.
So neighbors would have the opportunity to have...
Yeah, a typical special use permit process, it has all notification, publication requirements, and the ordinance already does have a pretty detailed, you know, conditional use process that it would go through.
What's unique about this particular one too that I really admired about this is that, you know, typically if you've ever heard of a PUD overlay, you think about the rezoning. So it goes from planning commission, you go through the rezoning process first, planning commission looks at it, you make the recommendation. It's an actual ordinance change, so it goes to the city council. And then you come back and you look at the plan itself. And in this case, it's all done as a package and only the planning commission has to review it. It's not an actual ordinance change. So for that site, you're going through that whole special use permit process as a contained unit. So you don't have to wait for that zoning, rezoning to happen to have it come back and then something gets messed up or you don't, something that you point toward with the rezoning. So you do it all as one deal. And it's a lot more effective, it's a lot more efficient too for the applicant who comes in to kind of know what they're going to get. Because they come in, typically there would be a pre-application conference, they lay it all out for you without any kind of formal need for a response from all of you, just input, and then they come back with the actual formal application and everything is hopefully ducks are in a row.
Basically taking that 6 to 9 month process down to about 45 days process.
So I pointed out maybe the most smallest example, a lot. What would, is there acreage in town that is left that would be used for? In other words, Harbridge Heights was 20, 30 acres, I'm assuming, and Manny Lane was 10 acres, I'm assuming.
There's not many big parcels with access to water and sewer in the city. So, you know, the opportunities are going to be, you know, the 1 to 2 to 3 acre sites that are around the county.
Mm-hmm. And does Leroy Street have any acreage in a big parcel? Which would be next to Harbridge Heights?
Leroy, oh yeah.
Yeah. That might have some acreage.
Or, Steve, would this apply to the house that we're working on at the top of East Main Street?
Yeah, that's three city lots. I believe it would. Yeah, I think it would.
Or the lots that the city owns over by the dog park?
Yes, yes, it would for sure.
Especially with that lot, the difficulty of the terrain, if you were able to break it up, it would be easier to build.
How about Main or M75 or State Street next to the food pantry, that parcel that used to be a car lot?
Yeah.
I've often thought that would be great for another fourplex or something. It's got all those manufactured homes behind it. So multi-family use would seem to fit in there.
And apparently it has water and sewer probably.
Right.
Yeah, right there. Mm-hmm. On both sides.
Yeah.
So there are enough examples that if we pursue this, there would be opportunities for developers to, to use it.
If you went with that 15,000 square feet, I did that search on the mapping system in your packets, those, all those, I don't know if you can see it very well, but all the yellow highlighted parcels are all 15,000 square feet or more. So there's quite a few to choose from.
I don't see any downside. Because, as Jim said, if the neighborhood really doesn't want 10 tiny houses, or 6 tiny houses, or 3 duplexes, the neighborhood has a voice in the process. At the plan review, right?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be like a typical conditional use process, so, you know, neighborhood character, architectural design, does it fit? Those kinds of questions are part of that process. Mm-hmm. So, if it doesn't fit, you can deny it. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
What about, you raised the whole point of the short-term rentals. I hate to do this and then have half of them turn into short-term rental. That's not really the reason that we'd like to do this, is it?
It's not a house. It doesn't, my perspective is we're trying to increase housing for work production.
Right. Yeah.
A short-term rental doesn't serve as a house while it's being rented out commercially.
But we have a shortage of short-term rentals too. I mean, yes, when I say short-term, I'm thinking of 6 months or a year minimum.
Short-term rentals is typically a term we use for weekend. I see what you put. Seasonal rentals. And and where you're just living there for a year while you look to buy a house because you just moved to the area or whatever.
Right.
Yeah,
we have a huge shortage of those too.
Yeah.
But the city commission is working out how they want to handle short-term rentals, weekend rentals.
Yeah, the city commission has approved budgets and put money in to obtain a inventory from one of the, there's these host compliance companies, there's several that do it. So then once you get a good inventory, what we got, where they are, how many, density, that kind of thing. Then we can review it, coming from us, good information and say, okay, what can we do and how should we deal with it?
Right.
That's a great idea.
But because of that, if we were to go ahead with this, we'd still be able to, if somebody came with us and wanted to use this tool, and we're still working on that, that could be one of our criteria to say, if they're coming to us saying, hey, we're going to use these for rentals, we can say, that's not a real use we want you to use it for.
Well, that's the thing. How you tie it to an approval.
Yeah.
It can't be some kind of deed restriction or something. Have to be part of it.
Right.
I'd recommend that you put it in the language. If you really don't want short-term rentals, just be really clear, because the level of investment that people make in a short-term rental and their expected rate of return is very different than what you get from a long-term rental. So as developers, you want this process to be predictable. So if they go into developing this as short-term rentals, their numbers are just not going to work as soon as you remove that. So because I've heard different attorney opinions that a short-term rental ordinance can't create zones for them, but in zoning, you can zone them in certain places. So I don't know who your attorney, Lange's attorney is, but I know Brian Graham's been stating that as one of the requirements. But so if you put short-term rentals, short-term rentals are not allowed as part of your PUD, then the city can still move forward with their policy.
Yep.
But to have that conversation in conjunction with that action.
Ultimately, I'd like the city to come up with what we're going to do with
this. Decided that way,
mm-hmm. How is this different than just putting an auxiliary building on your lot?
This would be applicable and allow for slightly higher density than just one lot with one accessory dwelling in it.
You could get, 3, 4 maybe in some areas.
Okay. All right. And how is this different? We use Mandy Lane as an example, but Mandy Lane was just lots. they took out acreage, made it into lots. That's not really what this is, right?
Well, the density would be the big difference. The Mandy Lane lots are relatively large lots. So, you know, those were to comply with the RED district and also the, you know, open space provisions of the ordinance. So there was a lot of land there that wasn't utilized.
So I guess what I'm asking, so do you take, say, a big lot on Leroy Street, and if you put in two duplexes, are they, is the land condominiumized because it's what do you call it?
A large parcel.
A PUD?
Yeah.
Or do you have to divide it into individual lots, like Mandy Lane?
That's a great question. I think it would have to be up to the particular situation, the particular developer who's doing that. Maybe a site condo, or they could, depending on the land division.
Right. I think the most realistic way to do that is a site condominium.
Yeah.
So you're keeping it in its total entity with using the PUD to get the higher density, but you're not dividing it into lot lines, because then you're getting back to individual lots with minimum lot size and minimum. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here.
Yeah, it'd probably be like a condominium, it's a common area. So you have the own the footprint and then the rest of the economy. I could envision it with small lots, pretty creative.
Well, similar to Park Place on the corner of Park and Division. I mean, that's what, 8 units mm-hmm. on that little parcel?
So yeah, I don't think we have to get into the mechanics of it right now too much. I think what we're looking at right now is this a concept that we should pursue?
Okay.
And is the existing ordinance the one that should be replaced with something?
Well, like you said, the existing ordinance, you said, is going to be twice. And that was mostly that they had to create open space to be able to allow big density in certain areas. Well, it's been used twice since you worked here. So I don't see it as a tool to be used. I think modifying it is a better option. Yeah.
So are you supportive of the kind of concepts that have been outlined here with the PUD concept, the smaller lot size kind of concepts, that process?
I find that I'm in support of that. I think that would be a really good thing to try and look at, and it sounds good.
I've seen some of these developments in Traverse City that are utilizing what it sounds like he's talking about right there along the waterfront, and they're very attractive homes. I mean, they're close together, but I mean, I could see older folks or something like that, you know, more community-like in that little space. No, I think it's something worth definitely pursuing.
Yeah.
I think as long as it has to be approved on its own merit.
Agreed.
Is the key, because I'm not in favor of it if it's just done willy-nilly. And I would want to see the criteria that gets established to be used in this before I would say, yes, let's rubber stamp it.
Right. And that's something.
But the idea, I can see applications for the idea.
Agree.
Yeah, I'm in favor. One more question. So the Holland example and the Traverse City example, we're basically, you know, here's the lot, here's carport, just have a U sidewalk with 12 homes. That would be an example that could be used on this.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Because we have a lot of those from Holland that were examples.
Yep. I think the only thing I would add too is one criteria that I thought of after I drafted this, and that as I started playing out scenarios in my head, I was thinking about the parking requirements too. And I think, and this is common, another thing that other places are doing are dropping minimum parking requirements for housing for residential properties, because people that own a home are going to want parking on their property no matter what. As you start to build some of these, like an accessory dwelling unit, if you can put that on your property, to reduce that to just one parking space required on the lot. And I think that can also be something, like you're saying, where you want to see it as part of the PUD. Every neighborhood's going to be slightly different. There are some neighborhoods right now where you can only fit two cars, right, barely squeezed next to the house, and everybody's parking on the right of way anyway, and the guests that come over. So you wouldn't want to add too many dwelling units to that place and still not require the parking. But still, to reduce parking requirements, I think, is something to think about also as you go through this. To not have two requirements per site, is that still for...
Yeah, that's what it is. But yeah, that's one of the other barriers, you know, you may not think about, like, the parking requirements often, you know, come up and pose issues with, you know, developments like the loss on Lake Street, you know, there's a huge discussion about parking requirements.
And paving's expensive. But it's nice to have.
Nicole, do you have anything like that?
No, I think, you know, this is a wonderful application process. So if I'm understanding, this open space would be then stripped from the book, and the PUD would take it.
Yeah, that's my idea, just to repeal and replace that article.
Okay, I think it's wonderful.
That was put in mostly in a lot of zoning ordinances in Michigan when that open space state law went into effect, right, the state?
This became in 2001 with the ordinance rewrite, I believe.
Oh, did it?
I wasn't around when they developed it, so I don't know.
Yeah, I was actively involved in it in the township I lived in before I moved up here. We rewrote the zoning ordinances to allow for planned unit developments. And that was a relatively rural community, and the applications that were brought up there were more like, let's say somebody had a 40-acre parcel, and so it was farmland zoning or rural residential large lot sizes. But there was a pond on the property and a woods on the property and things like that. It would be possible to cluster the houses on smaller lots and maintain that as open space and use it as the whole development to meet the requirement. Even though the houses would be close together, there may be walking trails or fishing ponds or whatever.
And I think the state law changed about that time.
It was about that time.
This kind of change in every zoning ordinance. The same thing happened everywhere. Nobody ever used it because it was so awkward.
Okay. All right. Got it. Sounds like okay. So for our next meeting,
we'll start working on the mechanics of this and bring something back and then see you as the meeting today.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. And if you have any other ideas, please pass them to Scott.
Yeah, he's been great help. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, it doesn't sound like either one of our appointments or recommendations.
Well, do you want to postpone any recommendation on this till later?
Yeah, I'd like to postpone until we get an opportunity to, at least till the next meeting. If we don't have any response then, we'll make the...
Okay.
Yeah. Unless anyone else has any other...
Just a clarification. So, how do we do that process? Is it an open vote with the candidates right here? Is it a closed vote? Is it a interview the candidate? Do you interview the candidates? What if one shows up and the other one doesn't?
I know, it's something that we've had...
Can't
really standardized. Most of the time, they come, we ask questions of them, and then we make a recommendation as a board there with everyone here. And I know that wasn't, we've only had a few situations where that's not been great. Most of the time, the people coming in are, we only have so many seats, and we usually get the same amount of people coming in.
So you get one person applying for one opening.
Most of the time. We've had a few where people applying, and there were some people that were kind of ready to be done, and so it actually worked out, so we were able to just bring it all together.
So we have a scenario with both of them here, and they both do their spiel, then is it an open vote? How's that work?
We've always done an open vote, but I'd be happy to take a recommendation otherwise. I mean, we don't really have a standard for it.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Which is the problem, I think. I think I'd much rather have a closed vote to that. How do you accommodate that?
Probably not legal, though, is it, Scott?
Well, here is your planning commission's recommendation about memo that you adopted in April of 2017. So, upon vacancy by any means other than expiration of term or recommendation appointment, the planning commission shall be included as a new business item on the next available agenda. The planning commission shall be presented with all the candidates that have completed Boyne City Board application and have indicated the planning commission has an area of interest. The planning commission may only consider applicants that meet eligibility requirements. That's, you have to be a resident. Mm-hmm. All potential candidates will be contacted prior to the meeting to confirm continued interest in the appointment and invited to the meeting in which they may be considered for recommendations for appointment. At the meeting, all applicants and attendants will be brought an opportunity to make a presentation to the planning commission. And the consideration of a recommendation to fill vacancies of the planning commission shall use the membership criteria listed on the planning commission bylaws as a guide. A motion to recommend appointment to fill the current vacancy should be made. The recommendation by the planning commission is advisory only and has no legal force or effect. Neither the city commission nor the planning commission is bound in any way by any current or previous recommendation for appointments. The recommendation before the appointment may be made by the planning commission and the applications of all other eligible applicants considered by the planning commission will be submitted to the next available city commission agenda for the review and consideration. So, basically, you just make a recommendation of who you think and send it to the city commission and they can do what they want. They can consider anybody else if they want or that is the one that you recommend.
In other words, we could actually say we would be happy with either one and send both of them and then let the city commission makes the ultimate choice?
The appointments are by the city, by the mayor with confirmation by the city commission.
Okay.
That's not cool.
It's basically, this is not a process that's enshrined in any ordinance. It's just a policy of the city. Mm-hmm. They do it for all their boards. And so it's just a service that you are providing to the city commission, basically to give advice on who you think would be a good member.
Yep.
In the planning commission world, there is the ordinance stipulates areas of expertise that you try to get on your board. And there's a variety of different ones listed. So you do try to, where there's an opportunity. But smaller communities where volunteers are few, it's not always easy to get that wide variety of expertise. And so you may just have to choose between the people that are interested. So.
Is Rose's seat the only vacancy we have at the moment?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we have two applicants for it. If we were to do a closed vote or anything like that, how does that work? I've never actually had to do that.
I don't know. That's my stance.
I mean, I'd love to meet the candidates and have an opportunity to email outside. I mean, talk about the candidates, but then make the decision outside of this. But
you can always ask them to leave the room while we discuss it.
Okay.
I don't think that's legal either.
I can't do that.
It's a little uncomfortable, but
In my opinion, we're just making a recommendation whether we make it or we're the candidate for the position.
Yeah.
And it's really up to the city commission to decide who's the more eligible candidate.
I think
we can kind of talk about their background
and
their experiences and look at kind of areas that you need to fill and those areas of expertise.
Right.
So there may be someone that's a little more fit to maybe one of those areas. So you could base a decision on that.
They usually accept the recommendation of the committee though, don't they?
Typically, yeah.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, as a city commissioner, we would appreciate the expertise of 9 people coming to consensus.
He just doesn't want to be.
Right.
I agree with Karen. I'd like to hear the one point that just looking around the room is we're a little male heavy and female light in terms of.
You don't want to.
You don't want to have that cap. I was at the city council meeting when they put Skylar McNaughton and Rose Newton on, and some of the things that were said at that meeting by commissioners were so illegal, it wasn't even funny.
Wow.
I was totally blown away by it.
You need to consider those areas of experience.
Well, they're both realtors, it says.
Yeah.
Oh, are they both?
That's what it says.
Yeah.
Although one's a realtor and a servant at a restaurant.
Yep, and both of them have worked within service organizations or nonprofits. So maybe there's some other experience.
But I do think, I really do appreciate them coming to a meeting, seeing what a meeting's like, having to be able to talk with them, but, and I totally get the comments coming down. I would much rather give them a better idea of what's coming down than that. So, but my question is that how then can you make, I mean, we're making a recommendation. How do you make a recommendation when they're both here?
Just do it.
Just do it. I mean, I went through that. I didn't get recommended twice. And eventually got on the
board. I remember when
there was a vacancy.
There was a vacancy on the city commission, and somebody said, let's appoint Gene Town, and they were ready to bang the gavel. This is 10 years ago. And I said, wait, and I was just a reporter in the audience, I was a chamber guy in the audience, and I said, hey, you know, Scott McKenzie ran for office, and he was the next minister in line to actually put his name out there and vote. You know, don't you think you ought to at least ask him if he's interested?
Yeah.
And so they delayed the meeting. Scott wasn't interested, Gene Town got elected anyway, but there was that discussion, and as Monica says, it could be a little bit of an uncomfortable decision, but conversation,
but I have had that uncomfortable conversation three times and finally got to be on the board. So it's something that happens, but I don't feel mad about it. I ended up doing other boards because of it. So I think it all depends on how we handle it here.
If their qualifications are equal, I would say ask them why they want to be on the board.
But the other thing is that we have to keep in mind that if we think that they're both qualified, mm-hmm. we can just say, we recommend them both.
Mm-hmm.
And really, kind of like, we've met. Not recommend the people we know aren't going to work.
Right.
And if they both are going to work, then make that recommendation.
Sure.
So, okay. But yes, for right now, let's give it, especially since this was our first in-person meeting, see if we can have the applicants come next time and make that decision.
Yes, what if somebody else throws their name in the hat or throws their hat in the ring?
Then I would obviously.
That would be brought to you?
Yeah. Yeah. So can you just give it another one to see if there's more people interested as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Staff report, Scott.
I have been looking at the future land use map, and I believe we need to look at that and update it. There are a couple of inconsistencies with the Jefferson rezoning and then the addition of the 425 parcels for the Cuckoo and Jervis Webb. So we have a map changes, and I think we should amend that map to get it correct and a good representation of the visions for the city prior to amending going into the whole master plan process, which probably will happen the next cycle. The census data probably will not come out until late this year, so I'm thinking budget for 2022-23 to update the whole master plan, but at least get the future land use map done this year to get that accurate and correct. So hopefully I'll start that process and bring that to you probably next month.
Next month? Okay.
There is a whole process you got to go through, and anytime you're doing master planning, you got to notify all the adjacent municipalities and utilities and all that kind of stuff, and then have public hearings and whatnot. But So just put that in your mind, things to start thinking about, you know, give a chance to look at it, see what you think, and where any updates or changes need to be made.
Okay. Very good.
All right.
Yeah.
Move to the order. Monica, you have
a question? Well, I just had a question on that alley. And who's paving it and how it gets maintained?
I can kind of clarify that. The applicant made that presentation as a voluntary offer to pave that alley in his application. And then that was incorporated with the motion to pave that. He has since indicated that that's economically not feasible to pave that. And you're in a kind of position where you put a condition on him that is beyond what the ordinance stipulates. That particular use is a use by right. So the planning act is pretty clear. It says if an applicant submits a plan that meets all ordinance criteria, you shall approve it. And that's what he did. He submitted a plan that met all ordinance criteria. He was proposing to use an unmaintained alley, so to require maintenance of that is a reasonable request. So that has been done. The maintenance agreement has been drafted and has been signed and has been submitted back to the city. So they will maintain that alley. They will snowplow it, gravel it, do all that kind of tree clearing kind of stuff. However, to pave that, that is an unfair burden on this particular property owner, because in the past, when these things are paved, it's usually done by a special assessment or a voluntary contribution by neighboring properties that will pave that and then agree to do that. So in this case, you know, it's not really fair to make him bear that burden for use that's allowed by right in that district.
Okay.
But he still has to maintain it and plow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
If memory serves me correctly, some of the comments in regards to the alleyway is that it's shifted.
Yes.
Will it be brought back to its original?
Yeah, and I have talked with the DBW Tim Foss in regarding, yes, that alley is migrating. You know, we need to trim trees, we need to get it realigned back to where it is. And, you know, part of this process when they start construction there, it'd be a good opportunity to probably realign that to make sure it's correct.
If I had known all this in the beginning, I'd have asked him to put in a driveway off of East Street, which would have made a whole lot more sense.
Well, they still have the alley, they still can use the alley.
Right, I mean, for access, but to drive in and get to those garages rather than go in off North Street all that way.
But that plan met all ordinance criteria.
Right.
You can't deny it because you want something different. There's no criteria that says they have to pay the
alley. I gotcha.
With that being said, after the fact, there were some neighbors that their concerns did sound legit. One of them was take the alley all the way through, maintain all the way through, to have access from both sides so it relieves the pressure on just the one-way entry. And the other issue was centered, so you're saying take care of that. After the fact, are those concerns being addressed, or are they legit, or is there anything we should do? Or
well, really, there's not much you can do retroactively to this.
Okay.
The alley does go all the way through. It's not well maintained all the way through. It's not plowed all the way through. But to require someone to, you know, maintain a portion of the alley that they're not going to be using, I don't see is fair. But again, that doesn't prevent any of the other property owners from plowing that or maintaining that portion of it.
Do you think only half of it having access meets, you say it meets the rules, so that's okay, but does it meet the reality of if it went all the way through, it'd be better?
course they don't want anything through to be better, but is it necessary?
I guess that's my question.
I don't think so.
Okay, fair enough. If you don't think so, I trust your professional analysis.
Yeah, I can understand the concern, but I don't think the impacts are going to be as drastic as some people say. I do think, the immediate concerns of migration of the alley and making sure that, you got gravel line, fill the potholes, that kind of thing. That is done, but I don't think the use is going to be as drastic as some of those folks are anticipating.
Okay, good.
Okay, just give me the information to report back to the concerned parties.
Yep, but the other thing is that just, I guess now we need to keep in mind that we can't, if somebody says, oh, we'll pay that, we need to keep in mind that they...
So that may not be a training opportunity, site plan review, what you can and can't do. There are differences between just a use by right and a special use. A special use is where you have that ability to condition approval of certain things. They have to have a reasonable nexus to what the application is and what impact you're trying to mitigate. But if it is a use by right and they submit a site plan that it meets all your ordinance criteria, you cannot say no.
Correct.
You can't put conditions on it that basically would dissuade them from pursuing that application. So you basically have to approve it if it meets the standards.
Okay.
All right.
Any word on the Lake Street locks?
We had a meeting on Friday or Thursday for the demolition. They look like they're going to tear the buildings down in May, probably right after Mushroom Fest, week after that. And they anticipate probably 4 weeks to complete it all. And then there's no immediate plan to start construction. I think that would hopefully happen the year after, but no firm, way things have been happening lately.
So
it's just going to kind of sit being...
So it'll at least be cleaned up and a nice, flat, level, stabilized site until they do decide to build. I know the financing was the big issue to get that in line, and I'm still not sure if they have got that completely figured out yet. So.
Okay.
Lumber prices.
I'm going to speak every time I get an opportunity. I'll do it again. I'll do it with Team Boyne, but sometimes we get beat up on social media as a community or as a planning commission or as a city commission, but I want to brag that over the last year, the pavilion, the waterfront bathrooms, the gazebo, Cedar Street, Terrace Street, Great Lakes Energy, IMI, the Fuki, and then you throw in the additions to the high school, and then all of our zoning barriers that we've eliminated, Fox Run, Lakeview Village expansion, we've had a heck of a good year. And I'm proud of that. We should be proud of that, and sometimes we need to just voice our successes and celebrate our successes. And that all happened in spite of the coronavirus. So, just wanted to say something good.
Thanks. That new clubhouse at Lakeshore Village looks great.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Just came up all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And where's Bob
come in and got 5 permits for the first 5 units on Lake Street, so those should be going in. Hopefully, it has been a pipeline.
Is there 5 of them are going up front?
5 on Lake Street and then
11.
11 in the back, I think.
I think it was more.
It was 4.
Well, it was 11, then they had to rearrange all that stuff. Well, I think it's 14 in the back now, the back of the
pit. Back of the front's going to be tight. They're doing a lot of work there, though, bulldozing. Go by it every day.
All right. Does anyone else have anything to add? All right. Well, then I